This is, I leave that to your judgment. But this is called This Year in Audio Preservation, and there have been, as they used to say in a different era, happenings. The first one, 3M has announced it will close its magnetic products division December 31, 1996. It will be converting the plants where audio and videotape is made to other uses within the company. Similarly, Ampex has been taken over by Equitable Life Insurance. The company is called Quantergy, and it will continue to manufacture and market tape under the Ampex name. I'm sorry, I missed the...
Will the tape come with life insurance?
No more than it has in the past. Reel-to-reel audio tape has been and remains the only medium endorsed by the Audio Engineering Society, EASA, and ARSC for long-term preservation and for good reason, which we need not go into all over again, although I can foresee re-examining this situation again very soon. From the accumulation of practical studio experience, which breeds information, 3M's 996 product line is the best tape I have ever used when making transfers for archives. It has the highest output, best signal-to-noise ratio, and when using their precision reels, the only company yet to offer them with quarter-inch recording tape, the kind of flat wind which assures freedom from physical deformation during the long-term storage period. Under casual studio observation, I have found 996 to be the most consistent from reel to reel as well. Every tape I make has a 10,000 and a 1,000 cycle tone at the head. I have found playback of the 10,000 cycle tone varies very little from one reel to the next. The greater variation of this tone among reels, the more the tape is acting like an uninvited equalizer for every recording. Further, 996, I learned just after it was discontinued officially, was the first polyester-backed binder formulation on professional dealer shelves whose chemistry worked in such a way, and this is Del Eiler's wording, that the result avoids hydrolyzation, not just delays it. That's very important. Ampex uses different formulations. Given the problems with hydrolyzation and the consequent sticky shed syndrome on their older 406 and 456 tapes, I have long been a bit skeptical of this company's commitment to archivally stable products. A recent press release from Quantergy's Ampex, dated April 18, 1996, claims improved archival stability performance for 456 and 499, which is their competitive tape to 996, of over 40 years, four times their previous claim. Fred Lane of Quantergy also says that they have indeed changed the binder of 406 and 456. Though the new formulation has yet to be proven in the field, it does show a refreshing attitude upgrade and the product implementation of it. There is good news, however. In a conversation with Fred on May 6th, how many days ago? I was told that Quantergy was the high bidder on the Professional Magnetics Products Division's assets of 3M last week. The information is so new that the lawyers are still 2 weeks away from letting the company know just what it bought. It seems, however, that the package includes the 3M patents, not just the licensing of them, including that for 996, and probably their present inventory as well. We don't know whether you can still order 996 and have it delivered by 3M or not. Quantergy may not only have rescued for us the best archival tape on the market, and by this deed, expressed a longer-term commitment to audio tape than we had any inkling of a couple of weeks ago, and in all gloomy previous drafts of this report, but also that it was bought by an American company, which assures our dollars will stay inside our borders. It has the further potential of bringing in some from overseas. Hurrah. Looking toward other preservation technologies, however, the picture is somewhat less clear. We still must make archival media choices based on advertising and hearsay rather than on test results produced by an unbiased source. Tests whose results we need have been conducted, and we have paid for them. The space agencies, the military, government medical departments, and even some national archives have paid national media labs and other testing facilities to examine various preservation media, the results of which have influenced their buying decisions concerning entire systems, as well as the variations among the media these systems use. Seldom are the results of these tests made public. And when they are, they never include a product name and number. This is sometimes held for those who commission the study, although often this is not even available to them, but is held in secret by the testing facility. The result is that it forces the rest of us to fend for ourselves, even though the means of preservation salvation have been determined. Since we are all taxed for these tests, shouldn't we be privy to their results as well? I see no danger to national security should the data about audio tape be made public. Occasionally, we get some trickle down from this work, but we should be able to see much more of it and with brand names. We need to make use of the Freedom of Information Act to create access for us. Perhaps a journalist or someone with legal skills who is an ARSC member and not employed by the federal government can help. I have asked the ARSC board that this responsibility be assigned, and in the traditional way such boards react, I am now the assignee. Magneto-optical technology as it relates to audio still lacks widely enough dispersed equipment, much less standards, though to this commentator at least, it seems a most promising replacement for audio tape. Incidentally, this technology is separate from other magnetic media within 3M and will continue to be developed and sold by iMation, a 3M company spinoff. The German solution, which we learned about at the last joint meeting with IASA, is to make a very large computer with a very large memory and keep all archivally specified digitized sound in the device's working memory rather than keep them on insertable media. There will be two such computers which hold identical information, and each is backed up by a generator system. I am unsure where this project is at the moment, but it is moving along in the German national bureaucratic pipeline. Long term, this looks like a fine answer. And Dietrich Schuller has not responded to a number of faxes concerning this, so either he's away or unable to answer, or unwilling to answer. Those of us anticipating the commercial compact disc will provide perfect, or at least adequate sound forever, will be appalled to learn that the manufacturing process is being deliberately corrupted. There is a good chance that your CD has pinholes and/or other problems which will compromise its longevity. Pinholes allow air to eventually reach the CD's reflective layer, and given that it is aluminum, oxidize that entry point, causing it to be non-reflective, which disables the ability of the laser to read that section. Commercial CDs perform just fine for a while until air works its way into these pinholes and begins the oxidizing process. This may take a number of years. The classic use pattern for recordings by consumers is to play a new arrival a lot when it is new and seldom thereafter. The reverse is true within an archival setting. Are archives storing duds? The underlying business rationale is most likely that by the time anyone notices that the CD won't play back, the supposed warranty will have expired. Perhaps new CDs should have a use before date stamp like milk. Oh, Only a few companies manufacture the test equipment installed as a component of CD production lines. I spoke with one executive from one of these companies who indicated that his experience was shared by his competitors as well. I was told that during production, his equipment was showing such negative findings that it was being turned off, or at best reset to lower the number of rejects. Furthermore, some plants just being placed online were requiring a more forgiving system, which would overlook these problems that he, as a subcontractor, was getting, and that he, as a subcontractor, was getting order cancellations, since some manufacturers now refuse to use his equipment. The fault here lies on the shoulders of Philips Sony, whose licensing agreements with all manufacturers require that these standards be met. Failure to adequately enforce these standards is allowing this slide in quality. Lars Gaustad, of the Media Lab of the National Library of Norway reports that he has been using a commercial CD tester to check his incoming CDs against the Philips Sony Redbook standards. This tester delivers ratings as well as numbers. From the three ratings, good, okay, or defective, 20% of the discs deposited in 1990 flunked, down to 12% in 1994. It is presently unclear if this is for CDs manufactured in Norway only. Is there a plant there? I don't know. Or those made throughout the world, sold in Norway, and therefore presumably required to be deposited there. Remember, national sound archives are legal depositories. Among other functions, their content is to be used when rights are in question and evidentiary copies are otherwise not available. Assuming the Norwegian figures are representative, here is a classic archivist dilemma, and of consumers as well. An appalling number of commercial CDs are in print for as long as the lifespan of the fruit fly. There are many discs where the entire production run seems to have been shipped to all stores the same day with no reordering reprieve possible. Does the archivist send his defective copy back for another? If he does, there are three possibilities. First, that he gets an adequate replacement. Second, a better than one in 10 chance that his replacement will be equally flawed. Third, that it cannot be replaced and he has given up the deposit copy to find this out. Since when do manufacturers return defective products to you? The solution is simple. Use a reflecting surface which will not oxidize. Gold or platinum come to mind. The amount of material involved in making the reflective layer of a CD is very small, microscopically thin amount. Mobile Fidelity is offering gold CDs made this way at about $25 each, which undoubtedly includes an extra markup for carrying a double inventory, as well as some portion for its snob appeal. Preservation was not mentioned in the advertising I saw. Considering the relatively small quantity they sell and the economies of scale, there seems little reason not to use gold for everything. This should allow the reintroduction of realistic quality control into the CD production line. In my opinion, CD makers should completely abandon aluminum. The pages of Goldmine and Discovery magazines are filled with advertisements and editorial matter which imply the belief by collectors and retailers alike that this is a permanent medium, safely purchased for investment as well as for entertainment. They are sadly misinformed. The recordable CD is distinctly different from the product which comes from the factory with the sound already on it. It is mired in a confusion of conflicting claims, at least three basic products with differing dye colors, and therefore chemical makeup, and reports on variations in product stability both before and after being recorded. In the April 1996 Stereophile, J. Gordon Holt describes a problem he had with a recordable CD intended for consumer rather than professional use. I should point out that the Panasonic consumer version he mentions includes a huge royalty which goes to a copyright pool and a proprietary system which makes it unrecordable on other equipment. He says, The dark blue-green color identifies the recording dye as azo, which I understand is the least stable of the three materials now in common use. Yes, the disc box warns users not to expose the disc to direct sunlight, bright light, or excessive heat, but it fails to mention how relatively little of these it takes to render the disc completely unplayable. I have found that 2 days in the sun can make an azo disc completely unplayable, end quote. Holt fails to indicate if this is before or after recording, though his wording indicates after, but that doesn't say so positively. which means if he's driving around with one of these discs in his car, and he's in a warm climate, he lives in Arizona, with a lot of very nice sunlight, that may be a source of the problem. Have these discs been tested under fluorescent light as well as incandescent? The ultraviolet component of fluorescent may affect chemicals in the dye, as does sunlight. And I've suggested at AES meetings and elsewhere that the solution is to put some of that same chemical mix that goes into the ultraviolet sleeves into the jewel box. From lab tests initiated at the Library of Congress and distributed by Eastman Kodak, it would seem that the most stable of the CDR media is that made by Mitsui, including that for Eastman, which uses a gold dye. There is also a product from TDK which uses a green dye. I am told by Colin Smith at Washington Professional Systems, the second largest professional audio supply house in the US, that there are a total of 5 recordable CD manufacturers, and all products, no matter how labeled, presently come from one of these. This is further confirmed by Ampex's announcement that they too have a gold dye CDR, and in my recent conversation with Fred, that they are packaging someone else's product. Some of this gives you a chance to see some of the products that are being made, who the manufacturers are, and how the prices have come down since we last talked.
Where is that from, Steve?
This is something that came in the mail. Some of you may have seen a series of articles by Steve Sancroix in Mix magazine, which culminated in a trashing of the TDK product, followed by a 2-page ad from TDK denying all charges. The crux of the issue was how long the discs lasted, not surprisingly. TD claimed 80 years. Mix described problems of a more immediate nature, which brought the 80-year figure very strongly into doubt. I had a conversation with someone in TDK's public relations office, whose name I couldn't find before this talk, where that ad was written and who actually claimed to have written the ad, where I learned that their environmental testing process baked the discs continuously, which gave a far more optimistic result than that usually obtained by periodic changes from hot to cold and back again, so that the sandwich materials flex. The latter is the process rigidly followed by independent testing facilities, and there are mathematical formulas which extrapolate lifetime from data derived through these controlled cycle testings for all products, not just those concerned with audio. These particular arguments concerning this product may have become moot. Dell Eilers of 3M tells me that the same dyes, used differently, now give a more stable result. Questions remain about the temperature at which the reaction takes place, since it is so close to those achieved in tropical storage areas which lack climate control. There is no hard and fast lab-tested answer yet, though I sense we are moving toward one quite rapidly. The system is evolving. There are also significant questions concerning variables and signal accuracy, dependent on the speed at which the CDs are recorded. Copying it 2 times seems to alter the copy's sound quality. In the same issue of Stereophile referred to above, John Atkinson discusses an interesting phenomenon. In comparing an original master with a number of production parts when mastering a CD, the two engineers who made the original heard a change of sound in the CD copy made directly from the master, but at double speed. Even though a bit-for-bit comparison showed the two to be identical, they were able to identify the sound coming from each 10 times out of 10 in a blind test. This sure raises some important questions. Atkinson is such a good writer that the sonic differences are described quite vividly. We in the archival community fight not to alter sonic values when copying, so this is a recordable CD alert. I have no idea if this is being investigated further. Has anyone copied one of these discs to the next and that to the next, etc., and checked how the first copies compared with the last? No answer. I checked the few sources on that one. Is the problem one relating to the recording process, or is it a shortcoming of the disc they used? No answer. This is further exacerbated by the structure of an industry which, in many cases, distributes discs, though they do not manufacture them, but merely put their packaging on another manufacturer's product. The product inside the wrapper may not be the identical product you bought last time, depending on who has contracts with who, how long they run, or even if they exclude more than one type being marketed at the same time. The problem is being caused by a phenomenon I believe we have yet to identify. Never mind creating a device to measure it. Never mind eliminating the problem it is causing. It wouldn't surprise me to learn that there are other such phenomena created in the digital domain. We've had them before. Remember jitter? That was an unknown phenomenon when CDs first began, and gradually, as the data began to accumulate, the cause of the basically laser mistracking was uncovered. We're not just looking at theory here or at some additional arcane measurements. A behavioral change may indicate a possible pointer to digital generational alterations, something we presently lack and desperately need, and I'll have more to say about that shortly. Two other issues associated with a recordable CD concern the reliability and even workability of CDs which are recorded a portion at a time until the disc is filled. In practice, it is turning out that the disc works far better when recorded all at once. The other is compatibility of recorded CDs with machines of different manufacturers. I am told there continues to be a reliability difficulties here as well. Gerald Gibson of the Library of Congress Preservation Office says in a memo dated May 3, 1996, "We are hearing reports of and having some minor problems ourselves with media and equipment incompatibility. Discs recorded on one machine will not consistently play on others. Also, though we have not yet attempted to do so, we hear of problems with error detection on CDRs using normal test equipment." A problem which involves both the manufactured CD and the recordable one is that of labeling. The Library of Congress is beginning the process of publishing its preservation policy standards. Everybody write that down. And throw it back in their faces when the first one doesn't come out. An important piece of news by itself. Their first is called Labeling Optical Media. Now awaiting completion of their internal approval process. Their conclusion, don't put any labels on unless the disc manufacturer approves it. That. At an AES panel on audio preservation in the commercial and professional archive fields, a question was asked of seven large toupees, bigwigs, one of whom is another member of this committee, Gerald Gibson. From the standpoint of long-term storage, not one of the seven hesitated in voting DAT too unreliable. I have that on tape. I couldn't find the tape. Cataloging problem. I have also just heard, as I was packing the stuff up to leave the house, that NPR is having difficulty with one of their portable DATs on more than one unit. That is, on more than one machine. I don't know, yet know whether it's one brand or one model or all their portables. Whatever this model is, or these models may be, it seems to show all the signs that it is recording, meters bouncing, lights flashing, etc., but the tapes are blank. More about this as I get further information. DVD. Okay, you knew this was coming. The DVD, digital video disc, or various other translations of that acronym, it holds more than the same size disc as a regular CD does. You'll need a new player, but it should also play your old CD, assuming they'll play. Audio standards are still being put together as we speak, though those for video, which involve a certain amount of compression, are well along. We're still some distance from a recordable one for professional use, perhaps a year or two, even if they can get the standards together. May I suggest that it be allowed to choose its own sampling rate and word size from a computer menu? More at the AES, I'm sure, and more here next year if anyone in the trade is still talking to me after all of the above. And I just learned at lunch, and we'll have more in a moment, of some further developments in that area. New law. Sam, are you here? Thank you. There is a law being contemplated by Congress to extend copyright to a records producer, a new right altogether. The effect on the archives would be to cover the use of a dubbed copy of a record which may otherwise be in the public domain. If the record companies reissue these once every copyright period, they would never be freed up. You would have to own an otherwise free disk and copy it yourself to avoid getting permissions every time you wish to use it. I will invite comment from the source of that shortly. There's one other great big problem. We're near the end. The development of digital audio technology is about to have repercussions through a mostly unaware legal and scholarly community. There is presently no proven and tested way of analyzing a digital signal to determine if a sound document is the original or a copy. Thus, no way of resolving the priority among similar documents with slightly differing content and which presumably come from the same originating event, once the data has left the computer on which it was created. Before the advent of digital processing, any alteration of an audio signal left a telltale sign as it was being copied, an audit trail which disclosed possible alterations to the original. This could be a spike in the recorded hum which underlies all electrically made recordings, a blip made as a recorder was started and stopped, a discontinuity in the sine wave of the hum, etc., etc. It could be displayed on an oscilloscope or other analytic tool. There is presently no such telltale stain in the digital domain, no signs left by copying or editing, or at least none which have yet been identified. A recording of a 911 call can be altered or have background noises laid over the original call, like a woman's screams. Anybody remember O.J. Simpson trial beginning? Then copied with no way of showing that this has been done. Morphing photographs has become a common technological skill, and this can now be done with audio. The wealthiest forensic lab in the world, that at the FBI, has no present means of reliable, confirmable analysis. It is my belief that this is about to introduce chaos into the legal and scholarly apparatus worldwide. No longer is any audio document trustworthy. There is presently no solution for audio except very tightly controlled accompanying paperwork attesting to the unaltered original through a legal chain of custody. Wait till the lawyers catch on. There are three problems which are often mingled in discussing this issue, only one of which is pertinent here. There is that of allowing outside access to a digital file, that of allowing copying of that file, our immediate concern, that of assurance that the file remains intact as it is passed along. A corollary to this last issue is finding some way to indicate if the file has been altered, and if so, by whom, and which is the original intended text. A May 6th Business Week article, Copyright's New Digital Guardians, discusses encryption programs which are lock-unlock mechanisms, digital signatures, which perform the identification requirement for our by whom, but will not protect the file from tampering, and a further holographic approach, which may or may not tell us if it has been compromised. It is unclear from the article what really works and how well, or for that matter, what is a real product and what is Dow Jones wear. I expect the solution we seek will come out of the need to pay for stuff on the internet, the systems to protect credit card numbers. Perhaps the difficulties encountered when copying the recordable CD at multiple speed using the yet-to-be-identified artifact, which is causing quality loss, may be shown present in other digital copying situations as well, and when quantified and metered, lead to a device which can at the very least establish generational priority and at best prove an item to be a dub even without an original with which to compare it, the audit trail we so badly need. Some of these and many other matters which explore the clash of previous reality with the new digital world are discussed in a most enlightening and easy-to-read fashion in Nicholas Negroponte's book, Being Digital. It's an $8 paperback, contains no computer instructions, and is a basic analysis which alerts the reader to various cultural presuppositions which may no longer be valid. Mr. Negroponte is a professor of media technology at MIT and founding director of the Media Lab there, and writes the back page of Wired magazine. He knows so much that he's not afraid to write simply and clearly. I've included the title page and a sample page in my handout, which I will give out in between the two talks. We have lost more now, the last topic here. We have lost more than the magnetic products 3M makes. We have lost the manufacturer who has shown the greatest interest in the objectives of the audio preservation movement, which they backed by designing and marketing products which meet our objectives. Recording tape, splicing tape, the precision reel, the plastic tape box, etc. And we have lost a friend. Del Eilers, their senior technical products manager for Magnetic Media, has, with the support of his company, been attending meetings and participating in the committee work of the standards organizations and advisory committees concerned with audio preservation for many years, activities from which he has now withdrawn. His refreshingly realistic attitude toward the part his company's products have contributed in both the positive and negative consequences of its use in audio preservation, and his willingness to share his considerable knowledge with us all, and in small words with simple charts, has helped many of us inside and outside this room to better understand the nature of the materials with which we deal. I have run just about everything I've written involving audio tape by him. He has always taken the time to go over it, contribute constructive criticism, and has often saved me from my own foolish misunderstanding of the materials and processes involved, and extended my audio education considerably in the process. Some of this talk and the paper on the audio cassette which follows are the most recent fruits of our interaction. Even in the chaos of downsizing, 3M has wisely retained Dell and shifted him to a similar position elsewhere within that organization. I hope that the other industry benefits as much from his knowledge and friendship as I did, as all of us did within the sound archival community. Doug, did you have something to add?
About the mastering?
Yes.
Well, yes. Steve asked me to relate a story I heard by a mastering engineer at Sony Music regarding an album by Mariah Carey. I don't know if you know who she is. But anyway, she didn't like the sound of the CD that came from the plant. I guess it was Terre Haute. And the complaint to her husband, I believe, was the head of the company. And so they did a test. They made three different masters and sent them all to Terre Haute. One a CDR, one a DAT, and one a 1630. And they mastered all three of them. And well, this was a very expensive thing to do. And made CDs from all three. And they could. What is interesting is that everybody could hear the difference. Now, these are all supposed to be exactly the same. A digital bit stream is a digital bit stream. And apparently, they were all identical. However, there were subtle differences. I'm not saying that they're strongly noticeable, but difference could be heard, and she preferred the 1630, which is the oldest of those media. And that's the end of the story. I mean, it's very interesting. Nobody knows why yet. They're looking at jitter. They're scrambling to try and find out what it is that they're hearing.
Yes.
Is there a reason why you didn't even make passing reference to mini discs?
Yes. Data compression is considered unsuitable for archival purposes.
Does that really matter with something with a frequency range, say, of a 78?
Yes.
Yes. More so.
Okay. Then I'll take any more questions or shock-mounted noises that may come from you guys, or else I'll go on when you all have your printout, your handout. I need to get the script in front of me because I realize a few of you people won't be able to read what's coming, in the back of the room when what I put up on the board here, which has small type, and you'll miss some of the good stuff. Everybody have handouts? There are more up here if required. Yes, Craig.
Steve, so after you bought all of your 3M stock, what do you do next? Is there any, is it just a matter of waiting to find out if Ampex is going to get the 996 formula and use it, or is there some type of alternative that Colts were...
The alternative is exactly the one you have stated. We don't know what the consequences would be within the Ampex company structure if 996 were to come onto the market through them, in terms of the people who were those who backed 499, for example, where they would lose their jobs, and if they're in a position to therefore block it or move laterally or continue to make a living within the company. As I say, the lawyers are still sorting this out. One piece of information which developed here yesterday was that there is somebody in charge at 3M of the transition process. Either Seth or somebody gave a name and a number, which I wrote down but don't have in front of me. That question might well be addressed there. I'm sure somehow or other it may turn out to be like Freon for people who collect old cars. It just may turn out to be an underground in 996.
Oh, Steve?
Yes?
Has 996 become scarce yet?
No.
No, not yet. So we don't have a stockpile.
I'll tell you when to panic. Shall we continue?
Yes.